The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salner & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salner, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, hello and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. We've got, I believe, to be a fairly standard Q&A show for you today. We'll start with one or two Social Security questions and then get into some other stuff. I know that we've got a kind of a buildup of annuity questions, so we'll make an effort, I'm sure, to answer at least one annuity-based question to start diving through that. It's kind of the lingering hangover from June, which June every year, as most of you realize, if you're a longtime listener, is National Annuity Awareness Month. So we talk a lot about annuities in the month of June every year, and that generates a lot of questions. So we'll try to start making our way through that pile. And then who knows what else Jim will bring to us to go over today. I'm a little happy heading into this weekend because it looks like we're going to get a little bit of rain that'll make my lawn happier. I know we talk a lot about the weather on the show, but it has great effect on the lives, on our lives, on Jim and our, in my life, because I try to manage about, I have almost an acre of grass. So it's daunting and a big part of my life in the summer. Jim has a very significant commitment to gardening, vegetable gardening. And so the weather also greatly affects him. So that's, I guess, probably the explanation for why we tend to talk about the weather probably more than most podcasts that aren't a weather-based podcast. So that said, I'll bring Jim in and he can share any of his initial thoughts. I expect him to also be somewhat excited about the weekend of cooler and wetter weather. But I won't speak for him. I'll let him say what he wants, and then we can dive into some questions.
Yeah, it is. I think it's nationwide. I got a little email alert about the weather change, and I talked to some friends in Ohio, and it's broke out there too, and they're only in the 70s and very nice as well. So I think it's not just us. I think fall is coming. The weatherman, when I watched him last night, folks, he called it false fall. I thought that was kind of a cute way of putting it. But what is rare, and I think everybody will agree, I don't know how long it's going to be in your part of the country and if you're enjoying this fall-like weather or not. He said out here it's going to stay for about 10 days. That's rare for us. This time of year to only be in the high 70s, low 80s. That's why he called it false fall. And he said we've had 46 days. This is from yesterday. 46 days of 90 or above, and he fully expects there to be more. In fact, he predicted we would hit 50 or more, so we shall see. But we're in a period of false fall, Chris, so I am enjoying it. It's nice. My plants in the garden are breathing a sigh of relief, which is always good. I do hope we don't get a false winter. And I've been out here 26 years, folks, and in 1 year, it was in, oh gosh, think it was 2020, because 2020 was just a screwy year between COVID, my stroke, and the massive Marshall Fire. I think it was in 2020 as well, Labor Day weekend, which is beginning of September. Remember, we got the snow. We got a 2-day drop
that.
Into the 20s.
Yeah.
And then it stayed bone dry and in the 80s for the rest of September and October, hence the Marshall Fire in December, which burned over 1,000 homes. That could happen. And that would bother me because of the hailstorm I had in June, set my garden 4 weeks behind. And it would just kill everything and just be the cherry on top of trying to garden here in Colorado.
That's pretty rare.
But anyways, we are in false fall. I like how the weatherman worded that, false fall. And I don't think it's Indian summer. Indian summer has to have a frost first, right, Chris? And then call it Indian summer.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're not there yet. I like false fall. I'm going to, even though it's false, I'm going to totally enjoy it.
Yeah, well, so will I. Okay, folks. So we've got, Chris is right. We do have a lot of annuity questions. Actually, we have far more annuity questions right now, Chris, than Social Security questions. But we will begin with two Social Security questions because we just kind of always done that, even though I hate in the office when people say that's the way we've always done things. So maybe we'll have to change it up a bit. But we do have two annuity questions, Social Security questions. But what I wanted to correct you on, Chris, you said many of our annuity questions are as a result of Annuity Awareness Month in June. Mm-hmm. We're getting a ton of annuity questions now still.
And, no, I mean
good ones.
I mean, kind of triggered. It's on top of people's mind. Still coming in from our discussion. I think that's why it's been a little more popular. Is it's top of mind for people after our focus on it in the month of June? Is what I intended to mean there.
Gotcha. Okay. Fair enough. All right. So before we jump into the task at hand, which is the Q's and the A's, I do want to make mention of an email that I received on Wednesday. This is more of a comment that a listener had, and it got me thinking, and I spoke to Joe today, and I actually spoke to Chris before recording, and we're going to try to appease this person. But Joe wanted me to share. Oh, she didn't want me. She just shared to me. And I says, I think I'll mention it on the podcast. Something that her husband said. So anyways, it says, Jim, thank you. I've enjoyed the content of your show, but please, please reduce the chatter. He calls it chatter. We call it banter. Over 20 minutes for the introduction before the content begins. You can and should be personal. But it's over the top, and all of us are very busy. Sincerely, George. I don't know. I thought he referenced a specific show, but as I read his email again, I think he's just mentioning that our show, usually the EDU show, and to a degree the Q&A show, begins with banter. I don't think it's 20 minutes at every show.
Every once in a while, but that's probably the long end. Yeah.
But here's the good news, folks. Here's what it's going to cause me to do before I share a little bit about what Joe shared that her husband told her. So Joe and I chatted this morning about this gentleman's email. And on the Q&A show, we do timestamp when the first question begins. So if you do a little bit of math in your head, you can kind of figure out, gee, if the first question is at 8 minutes 30 seconds, they must be bantering for the first 8 minutes, 30 seconds. I think I'll just skip to the first question. Does that make sense, Chris?
Yeah, as long as those are right in the notes that everybody can see on their, you know, whatever they're using to listen to the podcast, that'd be a real easy way
so
to
that's what
skip
I would
through
suggest
it if you're
doing
wanting to jump. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. On the Q&A show. Use the fast forward button on your podcast exists for a reason, and you just fast forward. Or just jump to it or scroll to it, however you navigate in whatever podcast app you are using. But no such benefit exists in the EDU show, like today's show.
That's true.
So what Joe and I thought we would start doing is Chris will convey to Joe. Joe is the one who puts everything wherever she puts it so you all can download it. I don't know how any of that works. So Joe is going to put in the show notes where we actually dive into the show, where the show actually begins. Most of our chatter, as he calls it, bantering, as most of you call it, occurs at the beginning, but occasionally during the show, we might divest a little and go in a different direction. But for the most part, it's at the beginning. So this gentleman can now read the show. Nothing I can do. If you don't want to read the show notes, so be it. That falls on you. Shame on you. But if you read the show notes, it'll be at the beginning. She's not going to hide it in the middle or bury it at the bottom. She'll put it right at the beginning of the EDU show, you know, to skip the discussion or the personal interaction between Chris and Jim. Jump to 8 minutes, 30 seconds, 12 minutes, 42 seconds, 20 minutes, as this gentleman says that most podcasts are. Just jump to it, listener. But Joe then shared with me something that her husband had told her this morning. I don't know when he told it to her, but she told me this morning. She said that, in his opinion, people who were complaining about that missed the boat. Well, I don't think he said that. That's how I say it. Missed the bus. As far as what a podcast is and isn't. A podcast isn't the 21st century verbal equivalent of a book or a newspaper article or a magazine article where they dive the author of the article or the reporter of the article, the author of the book, just jump right into the topic. Because that's how that medium is. You don't start with a magazine article where the author is going to begin talking about, as Chris did, False Fall or my trip here or Chris's trip there. They just begin the magazine article right there. And many of you, much like myself, grew up with that type of communication, that type of conveyance of knowledge and information. And you carry that thought process over to a podcast, which is not the same. Podcasting is totally different. Podcasting is not just the verbal or written equivalent of that. The podcast is built about trying to get people to understand who we are as humans. It's about getting the human interaction between Chris and I or the guests that we may bring on. It helps for you to build an understanding of who we are as people. It's conversational. It's not just the regurgitation of what's in our head on retirement planning, spewing it out to you. It's more human. But if you don't like that, you'll be able to now jump right to where the more magazine article-like approach is, where you won't hear anything that we say at the beginning, but you can jump straight to where we get into the topic du jour. Fair enough, Chris.
I think that's a good compromise. It really hadn't dawned on me on the EDU show that people couldn't easily do that. And it makes sense, right? There's not a question one starts at this point kind of a description anywhere. So I think that'll be the workaround for those of you who want to skip over the front end here.
Yeah, I thought that was fair. Yeah. So I thank this listener for sending the mm-hmm. email again. It got me thinking. I really like how, I don't want to say his name, but we'll just call him Joe's husband, opined to her, and she shared with me, and it got me to thinking, yeah, that is true. That is what a podcast is, and it's why I love doing it. Mm-hmm. I would not, for the amount of time I have been doing this podcast, I would not be blogging or writing magazine articles with the same enthusiasm, the same level of production, if you will, as I do on the podcast. Because the podcast, folks, lets me be me. It lets me be human. It lets me have fun. And that's never going to change. And if you expect me to begin this podcast or any podcast, I listen to many. And the good ones, to me, are the ones that I get to know as a human. The podcasts I hate, honestly, and I still listen to them because I want some of the information, but I can't stand it, are the ones that are very academic, jump right in, talk monotone, and they're out there. Oh, they're horrendous. And I don't listen. I listen to more business operational ones. And there's some out there, yeah, this guy might be, or gal might be really good at being the chief operation officer somewhere, but they're boring as hell. I'll listen, but it's painful. I like the podcasts where I can get to know the hosts more and get to understand who they are and the human element. And that's what I think makes podcasting has killed network news to an extent. It has killed magazines. It has killed written word and newspapers. People get most of their news and most of their interaction through podcasts now. It's incredible. And it's because they're human. Okay, I digress. Perfect. So let's jump into the first Social Security question, if you're ready. Jumping in. This one, guy got straight to it. Bypasses me totally. Hi, Chris. Social Security question, going straight to the man. Hi, Chris. I am assisting a client. He's an advisor, Chris. I am assisting a client with filing for spousal benefits now that the government pension offset, otherwise known as GPO, folks, has been repealed. We all know, for those who don't, it was repealed last year under the Social Security Fairness Act. And I like to end that with for government employees and nobody else. But nonetheless, he says, now that GPO has been repealed, the Social Security rep told us that my client will only receive the standard 6 months of retro payments, not payments going all the way back to January of 24. Chris will explain what he's talking about. This only applies to WEP and GPO people prior to the Social Security Fairness Act for government employees and nobody else. Chris will explain what this advisor is writing to him on. We were told the system, and I believe system is Social Security system, was not letting Social Security rep folks. We were told, quote, the system is not letting me go back further, end quote. And I think that's what the Social Security rep was telling this advisor and this advisor's client, that she, the client, was only going to receive 6 months retro. Even after I explained how I understood things, the Social Security rep disagreed. Could this be because my client did not ever formally attempt to file a benefit in the first place, as she knew she would get nothing due to GPO? I'm wondering if there's a technicality here that I am missing regarding who gets this extended retroactive payment. Regardless, I filed the form for a request for reconsideration to see what they are going to say. Your expertise would be much appreciated. Interesting, Chris, because I don't know what's going on here. I'm sure you do, but there could also have been some confusion between the, I guess, retroactive or back payment under the Social Security Fairness Act for government employees and nobody else, and the traditional 6 months of retroactive payments someone is entitled to. Could they be conflating the two?
Yeah, it's a little nuanced, and essentially, what the deal is here. When the Social Security Fairness Act was passed, it was made effective January of 2024. So those who would receive an increase to their benefits, or maybe a benefit that they otherwise wouldn't have had access to at all, it opened the door to that benefit. In this case, he's talking about a spousal benefit. So we're focused on the GPO portion of the Social Security Fairness Act, not the WEP, the windfall elimination provision, which applies to your own benefit. But for GPOs, to focus it on the topic of this particular question, they effectively said, we're not going to apply that offset if you're normally affected by it for any benefits you're entitled to January of 2024 forward. So it sounds like recently here, this advisor helping a client is trying to get the client to get spousal benefits that otherwise wouldn't have been available. Because unlike the WEP, which would only reduce your benefit, the GPO can completely eliminate when it applied, doesn't apply anymore, but when it did, it could completely eliminate people's benefits. So for those people, a lot of times they were told, sometimes by Social Security, sometimes by their, you know, their conclusion by their own research or by advisors saying, well, you may as well not even apply because you're not going to get anything because the GPO is going to completely wipe out your benefit. And I'm not going to go into the math on the GPO because GPO is dead now. Might come back as a zombie, right? Might come back in the future in a different form, but right now it's dead. So in this case, this client or this advisor was owed a spousal benefit if GPO wasn't being applied. So they went in and asked for it. And this advisor clearly knows that the GPO disappeared back in January of 2024. And I'm assuming was hoping they would backdate it all the way back to then. But here's where it's a little nuanced. Even though the door opened then, there is still the rule. The Social Security Fairness Act did not change the 6-month retroactive filing restriction. And what that means is when you file for benefits, you're able to file retroactively, effectively backdating your application, either back to your full retirement age or 6 months, whichever is less. So there's always, you know, been this rule. I'm assuming this client is well beyond their full retirement age. So they're trying to file retroactively and they don't want to be limited to the 6 months. They want to go all the way back to January of 2024, which as we look at it now, that's about 20 months ago, right? All of 2024. And we're recording this in August of 2025. That's clearly the hope here, but I'm going to pull up something directly from the Social Security website just so people don't think I'm, you know, misunderstanding something, because I think it's pretty clear. And I found this when I was looking into it a couple of weeks ago. So this is directly from ssa.gov. They essentially have an FAQ, a frequently asked questions section on the Social Security Fairness Act. And according to this, it was at the top here, it says last updated July 21st of 2025. So this is very, very recent, right at a month ago as we record this. The very last question on this page is, how many months of benefits will I receive? ? And I'm just going to read this to you because it's straight from the horse's mouth, right from Social Security. The reply is, if you were already receiving benefits that were affected by WEP or GPO, the last month WEP or GPO applied was December of 2023. Any payment adjustments due would begin for benefits payable starting in January of 2024. To receive increased payments for those months, you had to have been entitled to benefits that were either fully or partially reduced by WEP or GPO for those months. So let me focus on, before I go to the next paragraph, the word entitled. Entitled means something specific for Social Security. There's a difference between being eligible and being entitled. Eligible means you've met all of the criteria to receive a benefit, but you have not yet applied for the benefit. Entitled means you have taken that last step of actually applying, requesting the benefit, and they should be paying you. So the use of the word entitled there is very important. You're effectively already receiving benefits. Even if it was zeroed out, you had actually filed for benefits. The next paragraph starts, if you were not receiving benefits that were affected by WEP or GPO because you did not previously apply for those benefits, then you will need to contact us to file an application for benefits. The Social Security Fairness Act did not change the provisions of the Social Security Act that govern the retroactivity of benefit applications. Retroactivity for some retirement and survivor benefits is generally limited to 6 months before the month in which the benefit application is filed, although some claims based on disability may be entitled to 12 months of retroactive benefits. Those rules remain unchanged. Since the Social Security Fairness Act was signed, we have consistently encouraged people who have never applied or were not sure if they applied to consider applying for benefits, because the date of your application might affect when your benefits begin. And that's the end of their official answer to that question, how many months of benefits will I receive? They're very clear, and they're correct. The Social Security Fairness Act mentioned nothing about changing the 6-month retroactive. So there are people who are being made whole, if you will, back to January of 2024, but that's because they had filed for benefits previously. If you never filed, then you never started the entitlement process, and you are still going to play under that 6-month retroactivity limit. And, you know, it is what it is. It's unfortunate that you won't, they won't go back. They, Congress would have to step in and say, no, we see, you know, because of this technicality, you should have probably been getting benefits. We understand why you never filed, because you were told maybe by Social Security it's a waste of time because, you wouldn't receive anything because GPO would wipe out your benefit. So maybe you were, you know, in that status for years. And then suddenly we open the door to you as of January 2024. You know, had you known that was going to happen, you would have filed. And so we'll give you the opportunity to do so. Congress has not yet done that. And actually, I don't expect them to do that. I think this is in their rearview mirror now. They've, quote, dealt with it, and it's just going to lie the way it is for a while, probably until the major overhaul of Social Security that's going to have to come at some point. So I think this is bad news for the author of the email, that if they truly, this client of theirs, had not ever filed, they were never entitled, and they're going to be stuck in this 6-month retroactivity situation. And I'm predicting that their request for reconsideration is going to be denied because of this. Those of you screaming, it's not fair, it's not fair, I think this might fall under the don't look a gift horse in the mouth. You were given a huge gift by having a spousal or survivor benefit that you otherwise wouldn't have been entitled to under GPO. Now you can receive it in full without a GPO offset. That's the, quote, gift that Congress gave you in the Social Security Fairness Act. And the fact that you maybe missed out on a few months of it, you know, in this case, maybe a year of it. You know, shucks. I mean, that is too bad, but be more optimistic that going forward now you've got this benefit that you can take more vacations with. You can do whatever. Maybe your retirement is more robust now, because now you're receiving this benefit that you previously couldn't access. So that's the story on that one. And I, like I said, I read that answer straight from Social Security's website on an up-to-date FAQ that they have on this topic.
Correct. That was a very involved answer. Much deeper than what I thought. Very good.
Well, I just wanted to check all the boxes on it.
That is good. People expect that from you. Mm-hmm. Alrighty. Hopefully the gentleman who sent that in will appreciate your answer. This next question is a couple of weeks old, about 3-4 weeks old. It begins, hi, Jim, Chris, and the gang. Chris and the gang. Is that like KC? No, Cool and the Gang.
Cool and the gang. Yeah.
Jim, Chris, and the gang. Oh, he gives a state hint. You should get this one. My state is the original home to a brand of motor oil that was commercially endorsed by Arnold Palmer.
Well, there's only one brand of motor oil that I know of that I am confident of what state it comes from, because it's part of the name. But I'm racking my brain for others. There's one very common one, so I'm leaning that direction. I don't know where other oils come from, but Pennzoil originally came, probably doesn't anymore, but originally came from Pennsylvania. That's why it's called Pennzoil, right? It's got its roots there in Pennsylvania. So I'm gonna go with Pennsylvania only because that's the only oil that I know its state of origin. So
same with me. It's the first oil that popped into my head was Pennzoil from Pennsylvania. Again, I don't know if it's made there anymore, but Pennsylvania was one of the original oil producing areas of the country. So Pennzoil, and I had no idea if Arnold Palmer endorsed it or not. My answer was Pennsylvania as well when I read this, and I had to go to the bottom of his email for the answer, and it was Pennsylvania. Oh, so very good.
Nailed it. Alrighty. Nice. Good.
He's writing for a friend of his, Chris, and he says, a married filing joint friend hits his full retirement age at 66 and 10 months. That will be next year, in March of 2026. He was going to claim at his full retirement age, but now wants to delay to keep his AGI around $150,000 for 2026. I've heard Chris say that when not claiming precisely at your full retirement age or at age 70, one should consider the timing so as not to miss out on the start of delayed retirement credits, which are calculated only on a certain month of the year. Can you remind me how all this is going to work again? I guess he or she is going to talk to his or her friend on this.
Yeah. This is quite confusing how they apply the delayed retirement credits. So first, let's do basics of delayed retirement credits. When you delay filing for your Social Security retirement benefit past your full retirement age, which listeners of this show are typically somewhere between 66 and 67 on that. His example here, 66 and 10 months. So that person must have been born in 1954. No, 1959. Sorry. And March of 2026 is that date. If you delay past that, you get a reward. And that reward is they increase your benefit payment. Now, you delayed, so you skipped a payment or more. But they increase your benefit 2/3 of 1% for each month past your full retirement age that you claim up to the age of 70. And then you're awarded no more, quote, bonuses for delaying. That's where that 8% per year comes from. It's technically applied and credited to you 2/3 of a percent per month. 2/3 of a percent per month for 12 months is 8%. That's where that comes from. However, the nuance to it is when you delay past that full retirement age, they actually, and I think this was an old computer limitation, they only calculate and credit to you your delayed retirement credits once a year. And it's in January, so you begin the year with all the delayed retirement credits you earned from the previous year. So let's use his example as a way to walk through this, because then I think it'll be clear. Instead of me talking about it generically, if you see how it applies to a benefit starting in March, or at least a full retirement age in March of 2026. So if he were to claim full retirement age March of 2026, this person would get their PIA, their primary insurance amount. If they waited until, let's say they waited 3 months to, not in March, they did April, May, June. So they delayed June, till June to file, 3 months after their full retirement age. Well, they would get 3 months of the 2/3 per month. So they would get an increase of 2% to their benefit because they claimed in June instead of March. However, for the benefit payable in June through December of that year, they would still receive the same monthly benefit that they would have received had they claimed in March, getting no credit for that 2% bump. When would they get it? January of 2027, they would start to see the 2% increase because they would look in January when they do this reconciliation, they would look back to 2026 and say, hey, look, they earned 3 months of delayed retirement credits in my example. Let's give them to them. They don't ever reconcile that. They don't ever make up for that. The 2% increase you, quote, should have gotten from June through December in my example, you will never get. It's just the way it works. The only exception is once you reach age 70, if you claim at age 70, in that month that you turn 70, they will manually calculate and give you all the delayed retirement credits real time up to that month. You don't have to wait for January of the following year for it to finally catch up. So it's, for most people, not a big deal. I probably wouldn't change my claiming strategy around trying to maneuver around this. It just, you know, if you think about it, the trade-off. His trade-off would be, if I'm going to delay, let me delay all the way till the end of the year so that I get all my credits immediately. Well, they would get more credits. They would get 9 months of credits, right, by waiting from March until December to claim. And, but you'd give up months of just going without a benefit at all. So, you know, when you look at the offset there, I don't know that it's going to make for most people a huge difference, but it is a little annoying. You think with, and hopefully as they modernize some of the computer systems there at Social Security, I don't think there's a reason other than it's just the way they've always done it, that they apply them this way. I've never read any rules from Congress that say they need to do it this way. I think it's a transactional administrative reason from decades gone by where they essentially had, well, every December we're going to sit down in the back room for 2 days and we're going to calculate everybody's delayed retirement credits. And we're just going to do this once a year because we don't want to be pestered with this constantly throughout the year. There was probably some conversation like that back in the 1950s, or I don't know. I'm exaggerating. I'm making stuff up. But today in 2025, I think there's no reason. They obviously can do it because they do it for you if you claim at 70. So why can't they do it for you if you claim at 69 and a half or 66 and, you know, 12 months, which would be 67 or, you know, whatever. Just give me my delayed retirement credits that I'm due when I claim. It's just not the way it works. So hopefully my example was easy enough to follow that you could see that. So it's the top of every year. They calculate them. I don't know if they're physically doing it in late December, early January, but it's the January benefit that's payable in February that sees the delayed retirement credits from the years before. From the year before, the calendar year, any that you earned that previous calendar year, you get awarded officially in your January benefit. So, like I said, a little complicated, so hopefully you could follow my example.
I think I did.
Good.
All righty. God, if you saw my computer, it's so much easier when I used to print this. I'm trying to keep things... I got some things flagged, some things open, some things ready to be forwarded to Joe, trying to figure out what goes where. This is going to be amazing if I can pull this off. All righty, trying to find the question. There's someone who disagrees with us on something. I want to get to that. There's that. I thought there was a PSA. Oh, there was. Well, there wasn't a PSA, but there was one to you that I wanted to get to. Of course, I'm not going to be able to find it, but there it is. Perfect. I found it. Excellent. I liked this one. This is not a question per se. It's technically a public service announcement, but it's technically sending Chris, Mr. Cowboy Chris, erect on horses. Hi, Jim and Chris. I can't help but commenting on your last Q&A discussion where you started talking about the speed of horses. Remember that, Chris? It was one of the, I think it was the first state that enacted a speed limit, and it would turn out to be right. Connecticut, and it was mm-hmm. 15 miles an hour because of horses or something like that. I can't remember. And you went on to say that 15 miles an hour is nothing for a horse, that horses can like go.
I didn't say it's nothing. They don't walk at that speed.
Don't talk it back. We've got the script. You were making it sound like a horse jogs at 15 miles an hour like nothing. Let me read this email. I happen to come from that very state with the first speed limit, otherwise known as Connecticut. Mm-hmm. Let me start by saying many people in Connecticut and Massachusetts, for that reason, present company excluded, I will say that, often ride horses. And there are many places to ride those horses. Chris never tires of displaying his lack of knowledge about anything east of the Mississippi. So I think you were kind of saying that it's got to be someone in the West who's – because I asked for people to write to me.
I was talking to you about you in particular, and I said you were saying something, and I said this is coming from Jim from Massachusetts, where he wasn't really around horses and doing a lot about horses. I never claimed there were no horses back east. But anyway.
All right.
What's their point on the?
She said, on to speed. I actually was raised in Manhattan. And when in high school, I had an after-school job exercising horses at a local riding academy not far from Central Park. The school is now closed. Yes, Chris, there are actually horses in Manhattan, and there are people who know how to ride them. But I digress. No, horses cannot sustain speeds of 15 miles per hour for very long periods. I used to walk them in Central Park for 5 minutes. Then I would trot them, canter, whatever that means. What did she say? I'm not a horse person. I'm trying to read what she says. I used to walk them in Central Park for 5 minutes, then trot them, then canter them back. Mm-hmm. I have no idea the difference between a trot and a canter.
That's basically the speed that they're going. Walk, trot, canter, gallop.
You can get to 15 miles an hour with a fast canter, but it will not be for long. And that was the point I was trying to make. And you were making it sound like horses can just putz around at 15 miles an hour till the cows come home with somebody on their back. And
well, we didn't define how long that. You made it sound like you couldn't do it very long, like a minute or two. And that's absolutely wrong. A horse could go 15 miles an hour for well over 5 miles. I can make it to the other side of town here at that. So now could they go 100 miles of that? No. I mean, it is a living animal that has some relief, but it's, and I wouldn't say the horses we have out here and, you know, perspective wise, I'm not claiming back east. I mean, if you're comparing back east though, that out west here, the horse culture is a whole different thing. It's a whole different thing. It's far more pervasive. We've got a lot more familiarity with horses. Are there experts in horses back east? Certainly. But just the amount of exposure, that was my comment about Jim in Massachusetts and not being super familiar with horses. And I'll stand by that. I'll, you know, as he was reading this, I pulled up, I had ChatGPT tell me the per capita horses. And guess what state I grew up in? By far has the highest number of horses per person. Wyoming's got
that
one horse.
That doesn't make
for
you a horse expert. What was the last time your bulbous butt sat on a horse?
Probably 2 years ago.
Seriously?
Yeah.
You don't ride horses.
We
you
owned
have cowboy
a horse
boots?
From that point. Yeah, I have cowboy boots, of course.
You have cowboy boots. I've never seen you in cowboy boots.
I don't wear them around town, no.
Huh. For those who don't know,
Massachusetts,
Chris grew up
by the
in
way, it's one
Wyoming
horse for every 250 people. So there's basically a 40-fold concentration.
Yeah, but Wyoming has like four people in it. So
that's my point.
That's,
there's a whole lot of horses
that's why
to go around.
Per capita, there's a hell of a lot of horses. Yes, but there's like nobody in Wyoming. There's, you got more
right
antelope.
So those
and
of us
elk
who
than you do
were
people.
There were exposed to horses a lot. So. And horses right. that can run long distances for, you know, the Mustangs out west here because of their wild roots, essentially. And Mustangs every year, just so you know, wild Mustangs, a certain number of them are rounded up and domesticated. Those things can run long distances. Now, at full speed, no. You know, full out, like I'm running away from a bear kind of speed, which is far more than 15 miles an hour. I mean, a Mustang can run 40, 50 miles an hour. For a very short period of time. We weren't talking about that. We were talking about 15 miles an hour. That's it. Horse All right. could easily go 5-10 miles at that speed. So okay. if that's not long, you know, if that's not long in your description, you know, for a while, then maybe, yes, we never defined.
Chris, I'm going to get another nasty gram that we banter too much if you keep going on about this horse crap.
Well,
for anybody who's going to write another we banter too much, we send it to Chris. Because he just started with horses. All right, let's get to this Social Security, excuse me, this annuity question. It's kind of a two-for here. And it has to do with the research. This is not an old annuity question. I got tons of those. These both actually came in this week in response to what we talked about and we gave as an example, the high fees of a fixed indexed annuity with a living benefit rider. But even though the fees of the payments were going to be the people were going to put $1 million in, they were going to pay about $340,000 of fees directly from that $1 million. It was still going to pay them more income, whether they purchased a single premium immediate annuity later in life, because they didn't need the income for 10 years. They were going to let it sit inside the fixed indexed annuity with a living benefit rider. They were going to let it sit inside there for 10 years. And that's the only reason it worked, because the insurance company grew their pretend account. We talked about that. Go back to the show. I'm not going to get into it. But they grew their pretend account at, I believe it was 9.5% a year for 12 years. They were only going to grow it for 10 years. And because that pretend account grew so large, and the income payout, which was quite low, but it was based on a very large amount of a pretend account, it was going to pay them more than they could get in a single premium immediate annuity later, or with a deferred income annuity purchased now, set to begin payments in 10 years. And in fact, it was 20% less premiums going into the fixed indexed annuity with a living benefit rider than it would have cost to purchase a deferred income annuity today with the guarantee to begin payments in 10 years. Right. So we talked about all of that, and we got two emails in response to that. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to get to this first one. So he says, Jim, your August 2025 show was insightful. As I have heard on several podcasts, including yours in the past, how a fixed indexed annuity with a withdrawal benefit might possibly return more than a single premium immediate annuity or a deferred income annuity. I'm glad he tempered that and didn't say will.
Right.
He said might.
That's the right word to use.
It warrants looking at. Because it might. Sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it does. Okay, I could not find any information on how this worked or how something with extremely high fees could outperform the lower fee and lower cost simplistic options of a traditional income annuity. I guess it's the worm versus the shiny lure that you referenced. You guys did a good job of defining the default credit, which adds additional value to the mortality credit for those that maintain the annuity. But one clarification is you referenced the $340,000 as a quote-unquote fee, but that makes me think of a commission. Let me pause there. To me, it is a fee. It's not a commission. A commission on an annuity does not come from you directly. Unlike mutual funds, if anybody still buys A-share mutual funds that come with an upfront commission, I know they're still out there because there are still some registered reps, otherwise known as stockbrokers, who still operate by commission. When you buy a mutual fund that's going to pay the stockbroker or registered rep a commission, that money comes directly from your dollars being invested. But annuities don't do it that way. They'll get the money from you. They'll get the money from you over a period of time. And it's one of the reasons annuities will come with a penalty period. If you close the annuity during the penalty period, the insurance company needs to recoup the money that they paid the insurance agent. And they do that through the penalty period. The penalty period also serves another important purpose for the insurance company and for you. It keeps people from treating an annuity as a very liquid bank account style account, and instead forces people to hold the product for an extended period of time, allowing the insurance company to buy longer duration bonds used to back the benefits of the annuity. And the longer duration bonds have higher interest rates, so the insurance company can win that way by allowing them to make money off of what is known as the yield spread. They're going to pay you a certain amount of income in the case of a living benefit rider, or a certain amount of interest in the case of a multi-year guaranteed annuity that's paying interest. And if they can earn more interest than what they've contractually agreed to pay you, that's called the yield spread, the insurance company gets to keep that money as a profit. So the one way, or one of the ways that they can encourage you to not close your annuity is the penalty. Those are all called fees. The penalty is called a contingent deferred fee or contingent deferred sales charge. It's only going to happen after you buy it and only on the contingent that you sell it. But the $340,000 that this person paid over the life of that annuity, it wasn't even over the life, it was about 13 years before the fees essentially stopped, because that's when there was no money left inside the annuity with a living benefit rider. Remember, you're only getting your money at first. And if you live long enough and your money runs out due to you taking withdrawals combined with the insurance company taking their fee, and because the fee was so huge, $340,000, it didn't take many years. I think it was about $173,000 a year coming out. It didn't take many years after they turned the income on, I think about 3.5, before the actual annuity had no more money in it. That $340,000, though, folks, it is a fee. It's not a commission. A commission is an incentive, a payment incentive paid to the selling agent or broker in return or in exchange for them, or in reward is a better way of putting it, of them bringing a customer to the insurance company. That $340,000, probably none of it went to the agent in a commission. I can all but guarantee you that. The agent's commission was baked into the yield spread, baked into how the account was actually earning money. And it was also going to be recouped by the insurance company via the penalty period. If the people do close, they have to keep this annuity open for 10 years and then turn the income on. If they call the deal off and take their money out, the insurance company will recoup the rest of their commission, if you will, because the commission comes from them, not from you, like it does with a mutual fund. So I just wanted to clarify that. And I didn't get into this, but I did point out to the people, the agent was going to earn somewhere around 5 to 7% commission on $1 million. That's $50,000 to $70,000. I said they, you know, if you want to cut the difference, they're probably going to make about $60,000. And you have to also be comfortable knowing the person who's encouraging you to buy this is going to make $50,000, $60,000, $70,000. That didn't come from them per se, but it was baked into that annuity. So their income benefit, if they didn't have, they being the insurance company, if they didn't have to pay that commission, theoretically, those people, instead of getting $173,000 or whatever it was, maybe would have got $187,000 a year or $190,000 a year. The money that would have went to the agent instead could have went to them. So they right. did, in a way, pay the commission, if you will, yeah. but it didn't come from the $340,000.
Yeah, and this, I think it's, goes, I think I'd like to step in for just a second too, because I think there's an important part of the conversation, because I think it's why people throw annuities out, you know, the baby with the bathwater, because they're so hung up on some of these things that, oh my gosh, I can't believe somebody would make $60,000, or oh my gosh, like $300,000+ of fees. That's highway robbery and all this kind of stuff. You're thinking of it as a fantasy land where you might have gotten a better, you know, income payment if they hadn't paid the commission, or if there weren't these big fees, or the insurance company didn't have costs to cover or anything like that. That's a fantasy land that doesn't exist, right? So if you're going to compare commercially available annuities to a fantasy land where none of these costs are, you know, in that fantasy land, you're always going to be disappointed. But it's all, you know, it's like saying, boy, I could, you know, buy that steak at the grocery store. They've got all this overhead and this markup, and they got to pay all these employees. You know, they're not paying commissions, but it's all fees. You know, it's a cost of getting that steak in that nice, pretty package for you. You know, boy, if I just went right to the rancher, I could get it less expensive. Or, and then you're thinking, well, gee, the rancher, they're charging way more than the cost of that cow, that, you know, that cattle that they harvested. I should just grow my own in the backyard. Well, you know what? You have the ability to do that. You're just choosing not to, and you value what all the costs embedded in the process to get you to the steak. Now you might decide you don't want the steak. You're going to, you know, it's too expensive or whatever. You prefer chicken or what have you. But thinking of the fantasy land, boy, this steak would be half its current price if there weren't all these costs involved. I'm not going to buy it because it should be half price. That's, again, not the right way to compare stuff when you're buying it. And I think that's where people get hung up on some of these costs that are embedded.
Right. I mean, I'm certainly not defending a agent or broker getting 50, 60, 70,000 to put that couple in this annuity. Is that excessive? I don't know. You decide. I have to look at it, though. We were brought on board to look at it objectively. I had no skin in the game. None at all. So I had to show them, and we did. We did the math. Here's what you would pay in 10 years if you bought a single premium immediate annuity. Can you earn on your $1 million enough to buy that single premium immediate annuity in 10 years? Chris and I didn't think consistently and safely that could happen. So we looked at, well, what would we have to put in today to buy a deferred income annuity that would guarantee the payments in 10 years when these people want to open it, turn the income on? It would have taken 20% more money than what this fixed indexed annuity was going to do. I could have ended the discussion there with them, but I thought it important that they know how this annuity works. So I dove into it a little bit deeper and showed them that they were going to pay $340,000 of their million was essentially going to go in fees. Is that excessive? Many of you are probably shaking your head. Hell yeah.
But so I think it is if there's an alternative that's a lot less, right? But if there's not an alternative that's a lot less, right, then you're playing that fantasy land game.
That's the point. We wanted to look at the alternatives first, and they were not less. So, okay, enough of that. He gets into something where I think he's wrong on this next part, and I just want to clarify it. So he goes on to say, now where did I leave off? To get the same return from a deferred income annuity, it would have required those people to put an additional 20% into the annuity. I think the fixed index annuity makes this up with a portion of the fees collected from the payees. I think they later drop that annuity and therefore don't receive their credit back. He's correct on that. But then he goes on to say it would be interesting to estimate how much of that $340,000 the insurance company is actually factoring in and returning to the people in the insurance pool, essentially. I'm fast-forwarding through his email. I know the true amount is dependent on how long they're able to collect, but hopefully you guys can get to a ballpark. I want to clarify the air to this listener and to all of you. The insurance company does not treat that $340,000 in fees like mortality credits and divvy it up and say, hey, we're going to collect all these fees from people. And many of these people are never going to turn the income on. So let's take a bunch of these fees and return them to people. Mark my words, folks, that $340,000, none of it is being returned outright. A lot of it, a lot of it is actually being used to buy reinsurance, that if people in this insurance pool live longer than the insurance company's actuaries were estimating, or if the lapse rate on this product, and I'll explain in a minute what I mean by that, is far less than the insurance company is estimating. The reinsurance will help kick in. Much of that $340 in fees, not all of it, but a good chunk of it, is actually being spent by the insurance company on insurance premiums to cover those risks. A lot of it goes to the insurance company as just abject profit. These products are incredibly profitable to insurance companies. The main reason the annuity pays more than a single premium immediate annuity or a deferred income annuity, and again, this doesn't happen all the time. You got to crunch the numbers. But the main reason, the vast majority of people buying this annuity and others like it from competitors will never turn the income on. That is the single biggest way the insurance company can pay so much. That's called the lapse rate. And I do not know why people buy these and then don't turn the income on. And that was my biggest caveat to the people I was working with and my biggest caveat to everyone listening to this. If you buy one of these directly or if you help some of your friends, family, colleagues discuss how they should annuitize and purchase an annuity, and if it involves one of these living benefit riders, you've got to drill into their heads. If you put your money in this, it's essentially gone. Because this annuity, due to its very high fees and very low crediting on growth, insurance company has to make it up somewhere. That's another way that they make it up. They credit very little growth in these annuities. And with such high fees coming out, there's not going to be much growth in these. And there's nothing the insurance company loves more than people to give them $240,000 just before the income benefit turned on, then an additional $100,000 while the income benefit was paying out before the account balance reached zero. Then there was no more fee money for the insurance company to get, even though the income benefit would continue for life. Even though the account balance was zero, there was no more fee the insurance company was getting. But they got about $250,000 out of this annuity during the deferral period, the first 10 years. There's nothing insurance companies like more than people buying these annuities, giving them $250,000, mm-hmm. and closing the annuity and right. not turning the income benefit on. Okay. They do it for any number of reasons. Sadly, much of it, I think, is apathy, neglect, and failure to understand how this product works, or disappointment that it didn't grow much. So they say, well, this is a crappy annuity, I'm getting out. And they don't understand they bought that for income. There's any number of reasons why people, and we're talking the general public people, not people like you who are listening to the Retirement and IRA show or the Andy Panko show or the Roger Whitney show and all the other wonderful shows that are out there and really learning. No, I'm talking the normal people who wouldn't know an annuity from a hole in the wall. And they're as ignorant with investing as apparently I am with horses. It is those people who make the stupid mistakes and close the annuity. And I told you, I recently read an article and I can't find it and I wish I did. And I cannot remember. It was an insurance article from an insurance guru. And apparently this was an accurate statistic. And I'll find this article sooner or later. And it was either 40% never have the income benefit turned on or 60%. I can't remember.
It's a big
40
number.
Do and 60 didn't, or 60 do and 40 didn't. I can't remember. Do you remember, Chris?
I don't. Either one is a big number, though.
Either one is a big number. An incredible amount of these annuities with living benefit riders never have the rider turned on. So the insurance company doesn't turn around and give some of that $240,000 or $340,000 in outright fees. The insurance company knows they're not going to have to pay on a boatload of these. So they just go ahead and increase the payments to reflect that. And that's what you're seeing. Chris called it something, because mortality credits are on single premium immediate annuities and deferred income annuities, where the income payments that didn't go to the dead people who died before receiving all their money go to the living. Chris called it something different. It was kind of cute, but was it?
I thought it was lapse credits. It was something.
Lapse credits. Yeah, that might be a good way of putting it. Yeah. Lapse credit instead of mortality credits. It's lapse credit. That's a Chris term. That's not an industry term. Right. But I like it because it captures the essence of what I'm trying to convey to this listener. He's trying to ask us, can we estimate how much of that 340 was sent to the insurance company, I guess, outright as fees, and how much was actually sent back to higher payments to people in the annuity pool? None. None was sent back to people in the annuity pool. People in the annuity pool, though, benefited because the insurance company knew, even after collecting this boatload of fees that went to us, the insurance company, we're still not going to have to pay most of the income benefits on between 40 to 60% of these. I can't remember the exact statistic. It's one or the other. That's a hell of a lot of people backing out. So the insurance company actuaries can build that in to their algorithm. And if they're going to let 100,000, 200,000, 500,000, a million people into this annuity pool before this particular annuity shuts down, meaning the annuity pool for this annuity closes, they'll come out with a different annuity with a different name, but everybody in that annuity pool gets to keep it. So I don't know how big the annuity pool is, but when it gets to that level where they have enough people in, actuarially speaking, they're pretty accurate on how many of those people in the annuity pool they'll never have to give one red cent to. They can't tell you which people in the pool they are, but they know how many they are. And they're pretty damn close on this. So they can then factor in all that money that we would have had to give them, similar to a mortality credit, we will pay with a higher income benefit. That's how they're pulling this off. And the reason these are so popular and pushed so much, when you're paying $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 commission on $1 million deposits, not everybody puts $1 million into these, but you can see a 5, 6, 7% commission. There's a lot of incentive for agents to get out there and sell these. So they have the high commission that appeals to the agent, and they play on the ignorance, apathy, and neglect of a huge portion of people buying these who will give a fee and then walk away. So that's it. So anyways, I wanted to point that part out. But then we got this other email from someone, and it ties in. It begins with, Jim was right. I'm sorry, Chris. Can you hear me okay?
I had a little glitch there. I might not have read that.
Did you hear the part where I said Jim was right?
I did just then.
You heard it now? You didn't hear it before?
It might have been my filter.
So it begins with Jim was right, in case Chris couldn't hear that. And you heard it that time, though, right, Chris? I mean, I don't want to keep repeating it, but I want to make sure that's coming across okay. Mm-hmm.
Very Jim important to right. you, apparently, as well, yeah.
yeah. So you got that part. Mm-hmm. So I could skip it. I don't have to say it again. Just get right to the meat and potatoes.
Yeah.
So I won't say Jim was right again because we don't need to. I'll just jump right in. A few weeks ago, I sent in a question about an annuity that provides a living benefit rider. And he did. And I didn't answer. I don't believe I did. I answered his first question that had to do with something different. So I went back and found his email. But he went on after listening to that very show. And he started doing the calculations. And he said, it turns out he apparently had the same annuity that we were talking about, even though we never spoke about the insurance company. He said, I bought the annuity about a year ago with the intent of starting payments. As I said in my previous email, I really don't need the income, but it's just to do a better job of helping me emotionally spend the money. I think we did talk about this. Mm-hmm. So we did get to his question. And this is an important fact, whether it is a fixed index annuity with a living benefit rider or a single premium immediate annuity or a deferred income annuity or however you have annuitized, or Social Security or a pension, that lifetime stream of guaranteed income, that bottomless cup of coffee metaphor I give, helps you feel comfortable spending money. So many studies have shown that when people have to take money from their portfolio, they don't. When people are just sent money automatically, they spend it. And it kind of is what we're comfortable with. We spent our working years working. And we got a paycheck every week or 2 weeks or a month, however often you were paid. And you just got comfortable spending the money coming in. In retirement, that's gone. Replicating that can often help people spend money. Study after study after study has shown that. And one of the reasons Chris and I like annuities, in addition to covering food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare, five very broad categories of expenses that we call minimum dignity floor, but expenses that will continue for the rest of your life, no matter how long you live, covering those with a lifetime stream of guaranteed income emotionally makes you feel safer and more content. It ages well. These very complex withdrawal strategy types to retirement don't age well at all as you start to forget and misunderstand investment concepts. You won't misunderstand money coming into your bank account every month. So he is right on that, and he picking up on it. He didn't need it, as he said in his original email, but he felt getting this as income will help him overcome the emotional difficulty he was having of spending. Not quite the reason why we recommend annuities, but nonetheless, one very positive reason and works for him and probably many of you. So he continues and he names the insurance company. I'm not going to name it. He is correct. That is the insurance company. He wanted to get out there and say, Chris, he did the calculations. And yes, he is paying a 1.1% fee. And we were correct. It's not on his account balance like he thought. It was on the quote unquote pretend account that was growing. So his actual fee is a lot higher than the 1.1. So he was acknowledging all of this. But he said, nonetheless, he's still happy, essentially, that he has it because it is helping him feel comfortable spending his money. So he continues, I bought this annuity to start joint life payments. They will now start soon. He got a hold of them to turn the income benefit rider on. And they will be 5.18% of my now $612,000 pretend account. That will give me just under $32,000 a year. Remember, folks, he bought it for $436,000 a year ago. The pretend account, which is not real, is growing at 9.5% compounding, and it's now up to $612,000. So he's going to get 5.18 of $612,000. He does show his age, 68, and his wife's age. I'm not going to have Chris run, at least now, maybe off mic, because it's water under the bridge. But I am curious to see if a 5.18% withdrawal benefit is reasonable for a joint and survivor. The reason is the first case, the people deferred the annuity for 10 years. And that's where I want to go with this. Most of these fixed index annuities with living benefit riders truly shine if you're going to treat it more as a deferred income annuity rather than a substitute for a single premium immediate annuity. Remember, the insurance company wants to get years of fees out of you, and they want you to close the annuity. They want you to lapse it. People who buy this and turn the income on right away, that's not good in the insurance company's eyes. That's why this particular insurance company increases the pretend account at 9.5% a year. People think it's real. That's why I call it the pretend account. They think it's real. I'm like, oh my God, I don't want to worry from 9.5%. That's wow. Oh no, I got to keep that. And they're doing it to encourage you to hold it, because the longer you hold it, the more likely it is you will probably not turn the income on in the future for one reason or another. Or you just unfortunately die before turning the income on. So I'm glad it's working for this man, and I'm glad he's going to get $32,000 a year out of it. I'm glad now he understands a little bit more about it. I just don't know if it's going to give you as much bang for the buck as it did for the people we spoke about, because they deferred it for 10 years, allowing the pretend account to grow far more than what your pretend account grew to, if you will. Okay. So anyways, two good things. He continues on. I don't think we need to get into it. He continues on at other things that he was thinking of, and other things the agent told him. But I think he now gets it. He understands. He's going to turn it on. He doesn't need the income, but he's hoping the income will allow him to spend money. That's the problem. He's not spending enough. And if people are or the annuity is just sending the money out, he feels he will spend it. And he ends with, thanks for your insight on this and for helping the community as a whole with this complex and nuanced topic. So anyways, any thoughts on what he was saying, Chris?
No, I think we don't, other than I'll just kind of support his description of this is a tool he's using to help him spend more money. He realizes he has enough resources to live a higher standard of living, whatever that is for him, spending more money on himself, but he found himself emotionally unable to do it without the concept of the, you know, never-ending cup of coffee. So the I could totally see where an annuity could help someone do that, despite the arguments others might make that, oh, that's a bad, quote, bad financial decision because the, you know, embedded rate of return is this, that, and the other thing, or my spreadsheet told me that. Sometimes it comes down to where the rubber meets the road, right? Where you actually take what you've accumulated and you enjoy yourself with it, you and your family, while you're on this planet, right? And if sometimes enhancing that is not the necessarily the quote best mathematical solution. So
perfect.
I like what he said.
I kept reading while you were chatting. Mm-hmm. I do want to address something here because I disagree with what I know he can do, what he's said he might do. I'm going to disagree with it. He goes on to say, the agent who sold me this ensured me that the $32,000 that I will be getting out now is at least equal to what I would have received if I bought a single premium immediate annuity for the $436,000 that I put in a year ago. Hopefully the agent is correct on that. I think what the agent is trying to point out to you is what I just said. You get more bang for the buck if you deferred it. But now that you're turning it on, you never told me originally how long you were going to wait. Maybe the agent put you in this thinking you were going to wait, similar to the other people, 10 years. Now the agent is telling you, hey, yeah, you're turning it on early, but hey, relax. Even though your pretend account didn't grow as much and you're only getting 5.18% of it, it is still on par with what you would have got if you bought a SPIA with that 436. Hopefully he's correct on that. It's what you wrote next, listener, that concerned me. You did say, well, actually, this next part didn't concern me. It's a sentence after the sentence. You did say, since I did this for the income, I think I'm still okay turning it on earlier. And personally, I'm okay with the high fees that I am paying. I agree you should be okay with the high fees you are paying if, for sure, what your agent said is true, that you and your wife, you can go to immediateannuities.com, put in your ages that you are now, put in the $436,000 that you put into this annuity a year ago, and see if your agent is right. that you're going to get about as much out of the annuity with the living benefit rider as you would if you had just bought a SPIA. Now, I'm not going to throw your agent under the boat on this. If you went into that office and told him or her you were going to turn this on into the future, not in a year, and they put you in this, that could be fine. So if this doesn't work out like your agent said, it's not, I wasn't privy to the conversation, it's not necessarily his or her fault if you were originally going to delay it. Mm-hmm. But if you want that knowledge, you can easily figure it out. But it's what he wrote here, Chris. And I still have the option to turn the income of the living benefit off later if I choose. And if I did that, perhaps when both my wife and I are dead, there will be some money left in the account for beneficiaries. Do not do that.
Right.
At all, listener. If you shut the income off, what doesn't shut off, Chris?
The fees. Still
the
coming
fees.
Up.
What the hell are you paying for an income rider for if you're not going to take the income?
Yep. Plus, the money they give you back initially is yours, so the account balance is going to drop in
exactly.
The early years of the income. So trying to, quote, build it back up for an inheritance probably
is
misguided.
Wrong.
Yeah.
You want to leave an inheritance. I said this mm-hmm. when we spoke about this particular annuity, but you can talk about any fixed index annuity with a living benefit rider. If you are looking to get growth, I wouldn't be in a fixed index annuity, but if you were looking to get growth, you don't throw an income rider on top of it. Because the fees are outrageous, especially if there's a pretend account involved. And also, what you would have been the people we were just warning about. If you turn this on and then shut it off and keep paying a fee, but never turn the income off, that's as bad as someone just walking away from the annuity totally and just taking their money out. Mm-hmm. The insurance company would love you even more because they get to continue to get the fee. You want your account balance to reach zero. When you buy an income benefit, you're not buying an inheritance. They're the mirror opposite, listener. If you want to leave an inheritance, get the hell out of an income annuity. Because an income annuity is designed to pay income and insure you if you live a very long time and keep paying the older you when you no longer have the financial ability to understand things or the mental ability to understand finances. You'll understand this payment coming in and it simplifies things. If you want to leave an inheritance, you earmark dollars off to the side and you leave it as an inheritance. Until this annuity reaches zero, you lost. And if we're going to put winners and losers, if you don't live long enough to watch this annuity reach zero, and now the money is coming from the insurance company, you quote unquote lost. If you were my client and you're not, so this is my opinion, it is not specific advice. But if you were my client, I would be encouraging you. If you came back and said, Jim, I'm gonna keep this, but shut the income off because I'm hoping that this will amass to some money for my kid, I'm going to say, let's get the hell out of this. The fees are too high. We can move it to another annuity if you want this annuity for some reason. But let's get into a lower cost annuity without this income benefit rider. But if somebody came to me and said, I want to leave an inheritance to my children, I'm not going to put them into an annuity with a living benefit income rider. Mm-hmm. I wish I was a doctor here, but that's like giving aspirin to someone who came in with a artery that's bleeding. It's not going to cure the issue. The guy didn't have a headache. He's got a bleeding artery. If somebody comes to me and they want to leave a guaranteed inheritance and I'm putting them in a product that's designed to pay an income stream during their life, but they're saying, I want to use this at my death, you've got the wrong product for the goal that you are trying for. I would encourage you not to shut this off if you turn it back on. You or your wife, you're going to do this as joint. one of you, I hope, is alive to watch this annuity reach zero and then lives a very long time after that to keep getting money to make up for the hundreds of thousands of dollars in fees that you are going to pay, not quite as many fees as the other person. You probably would pay about 100,000 in fees, not hundreds. The person with a million was going to pay 340,000. But you still are giving a hell of a lot of money in fees. And I want to see you live long enough. Any thoughts on that, Chris? Because you deal more with clients in the payout phase than I do.
Yeah, I think obviously you reevaluate it in the future when you're thinking you might do this, and maybe the situation has changed, but it seems unlikely that that is an optimal approach, plan to shut that income off once you've started it. I don't see the numbers working out in your favor in that.
Absolutely.
So that'll have to wrap us for today.
Wrap because you have to go, or I'll let you answer it. It's a guy's got a quick question. He doesn't understand RMDs. Vanguard is right. I just want to defend Vanguard here. If you got one quick question, answer this guy.
If it's super quick, but we're at approaching an hour and a half already.
I know, that's fine. People can fast forward. I like to get to one non-social security and annuity question.
That's fine.
We'll skip I've the got state the time. Hint.
Okay.
He said, I have a question. And remember, Vanguard is right. They're giving you good advice, listener. He said, I have a question about required minimum distributions. Mm-hmm. My mom sadly passed away in February of this year, 2025. And we're sorry, listener, for your loss. She was 72, but she was going to turn 73 in September of this year, had she lived. It's my understanding from listening to the show that her required minimum distribution essentially took effect January 1st. He's correct. Yep. Beginning January 1st of this year, had your mom lived, she would have had to have taken a required minimum distribution. RMD rules apply. You are correct, listener. But he continues. I am the sole beneficiary of the account, and it is held with Vanguard. I thought I was going to have to take an RMD this year because it was due on January 1st. But Vanguard, according to their RMD calculator, says no. Mm-hmm. No required minimum distribution is due. He's talking about the year of death required minimum distribution, right. The RMD that his mom would have to take. His mom died in February. Beginning January 1st of this year, she is in her RMD phase. No doubt about it. But the key is the timing. Chris will get to this in a second of when the mom died. The Vanguard RMD calculator says that no RMD is due this year because mom had not reached what they called her required beginning date. So my questions are, who is right? Do I have to take my mom's required minimum distribution this year and every year? Or can I allow my mom's account to sit there and only take it out as I please over the next 10 years? My name is blank, he gives it, but of course, you can call me George. Help George out here.
Yeah. So the key is she passed before that required beginning date. Required beginning date is the official technical date after which, upon which and thereafter, you must, if you're alive, take RMDs if you have an account that has RMDs affecting it. So the required beginning date is April 1st of the year following the year that you turn RMD age. And I'm saying it like that because for her, it was the year she turned 73, which was this year. She hadn't turned 73 before she died, but she was going to. So this is the first year RMDs are a question. And her required beginning date, though, is April 1st of next year. She didn't live long enough to reach it. So in the eyes of the rules, she never had to take an RMD. Therefore, you inheriting the account are going to, not have to play by the RMD rules during the 10-year period that you have to drain the account. So that's why Vanguard correctly is telling you, you've got that 10-year period to take it out, but there's no RMDs to deal with. at this point. So later on, for those of you born in 1960 or thereafter, your required beginning date is going to be April 1st of the year following the year you turn 75, assuming they don't change the rules, you know, which they have the power to do. So that's why it just happened to be the timing here. She hadn't reached her required beginning date. And it's when you inherit an account from a non-spouse where they had reached their required beginning date that you then have to worry about RMDs during the first 9 years of the 10-year period. In this case, she had not reached her required beginning date. Neither she nor you are required to take minimum distributions. You simply have to play by the 10-year rule on that inherited account you have.
Perfect. Told you it was going to be fast.
Yeah, pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
Yeah, perfect. So there you go. So if you've got your own questions, you want to send them in, the way you get questions to us is send them directly to Jim. Email them to jim@jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Indicate in the subject line it's a question for the podcast and include a word or two about the topic area. And we'll do our best to try to get you an answer. And yeah, we really appreciate everybody listening. Jim, enjoy our false fall. I know I am. It's nice and cloudy up here in Fort Collins as we're recording this. Looks nice and cool out there. I'm going to step outside, let my dogs go outside, so I'll see. But it looks very comfortable outside, so that excites me. Everybody will be back.
I never knew you were such a fall fan because you relish summer.
Oh, I love fall. Oh, you know I love fall. Now you're just teasing me.
Not as much as I do. You don't complain nearly as much about the heat as I do. That's why.
Well,
you seem to tolerate it a lot better than I do.
I'm inside most of the time in the summertime, so it's not. And I'm not out gardening. If I had your big garden, I'd be complaining about it all the time. It's the grass, at least, I have on an automatic watering system, and I just have to mow it. And unfortunately, with all the water restrictions, and they've jacked up our water rates up here, that I've had to really cut back on my watering. So my lawn kind of makes me a little bit sad because it looks kind of sad. So this will perk it up a little bit, having some cool wet weather. So that is exciting to me.
Well, enjoy. And everybody, thank you again for listening. And we hope you found the information valuable. If you have any questions, you send them in and we hopefully will get to them. We can't get to all of them, but I try my best to get to them and we'll go from there.
Yep. Sounds good. Take care and everyone stay safe. We'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.